Then, out of the blackness in his mind, he thought that he heard Dernhelm speaking, yet now the voice seemed strange, recalling some other voice that he had known.
"Begone, foul Dwemerlake, Lord of Carrion. Leave the dead in peace."
A cold voice answered,
"Come not between the Nazgul and his prey, or he will not slay thee in thy turn. He will bear thee away to the houses of lamentation beyond all darkness, where thy flesh shall be devoured and thy shriveled mind be left naked to the lidless eye."
A sword rang as it was drawn.
"Do what you will, but I will hinder it if I may."
Then Mary heard of all sounds in that hour the strangest. It seemed that Dernhelm laughed, and the clear voice was like the ring of steel.
"But no man am I. You look upon a woman. Eowyn I am, Eamon's daughter. You stand between me and my lord and kin. Begone if you be not deathless. For living or dark undead, I will smite you if you touch him."
Wow. Welcome to a sacred fellowship of goosebumps. This is episode 73, where your hosts, Catherine Olson, and myself, Lorianne Schwenk, and guest, Hillary Sterling, will be discussing the sixth chapter in the War of the Ring, the Battle of the Pelennor Fields, through the theme of identity. On our podcast, we are using sacred practices to read the works of J.R.R. Tolkien. We are using these texts to learn, to reflect on our lives, and to think about life's big questions.
Take a seat. Never mind, there's a battle going on and nowhere to sit, or settle in your car as Hillary is doing, and join us. Reading in community is an essential part of what it means for us to treat a text as sacred, and we're glad you're here to continue building community with us. We believe that by treating classics like The Lord of the Rings as sacred, we will learn to treat one another as sacred.
Hello
to you both.
Catherine, hello, Hillary. Welcome, welcome. Good evening.
Thank you.
I cannot get over this chapter, and I am so delighted that we are here to discuss this. It is wonderful. So before we get to a story on identity from Hillary this week, our guest, does anybody have a dungeon or a tower? Catherine, would you like to start us off?
Well, my tower is that on this Friday, October 1st, I will be getting published again. My anthology, Miracle on Deck 34 and Other Yuletide Tales, is officially coming out. And after months and months of effort and sometimes borrowing Hillary's back office because she has better air conditioning, it is finally going to be out of my hands and out there for the world to see. On the other hand, I do have an increasing number of friends who are having breakthrough cases, and while it is a privilege to pray for them and to try to help in some way, I often feel helpless, and I hope that my paltry efforts are really something that can be done and magnified by God.
Hillary, do you have a dungeon or a tower you'd like to share?
Oh, in terms of, and something this actually plays into a little bit of the theme this week, I was able to take some time this last weekend to spend some time in my garden. I'm an avid gardener, and my currant bush was ready to be picked and make some jam with it. And I've just been very, very busy for months, and I was a long hauler with COVID for a while. And so to be able to just be out and enjoying that time and having the strength and the energy and the sunshine to do it was beautiful. And I really appreciated that.
Beautiful. What will you do with all those currants?
Oh, they are already jam.
Awesome. Wonderful. Nothing like that little pop. Right?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Wonderful. Is there any dungeon to that, or just the busyness recently?
The dungeon is mostly the busyness and like Catherine, I'm facing a lot of concerns with the uptick in cases and and yet again needing to adjust life.
Right.
But but knowing that we know how to do this and that we've been given tools that we didn't have in the past. And those are my comfort.
That is a lovely way to put that. That is right. We can do this. We really can. I'll join in. My dungeon's the same. I was supposed to have a meeting tomorrow, and even though it was going to be on Zoom, the chair of the committee is sick, and it's scary and just very sobering to think about. And then my tower is... On Friday, my friend has her book coming out, and I'm really excited to read Miracle on Deck 34 and Other Christmas Stories. And when we get to the end of this episode, I've got a little extra something to say about that book. Whoa. So there we are. So Hillary, you said you had a story for us on identity, which is our theme for this chapter on the Pelennor Fields. Tell us.
Well, if you will permit me for just a second, if anyone wonders where I found this obviously professional voice actress to do the Eowyn impression, this is the person who has been very vigilantly keeping us all safe, and her husband and her son make sure that we are able to participate in the church every week. But most importantly, she's been a good friend and a follower of the podcast and all things Tolkien. And this is obviously Hillary Sterling, a treasured member of our community. So with all that pressure, go ahead, Hillary, tell us about yourself.
interweaving in your story or after or before, could you tell us how you got introduced to Tolkien as well?
Sure. And that might be a good point to lead out with. I first read Lord of the Rings when I was 9 years old. It took me a while to get through my first reading of it, but it was one where, you know, with all the imagination of a nine-year-old, I created space for myself in the fellowship, as you know, young writers and are want to do. It was a Mary Sue, I'll admit it, but didn't write it down until I came to Eowyn, The Slender's a Steel Blade. I was much closer to that then than I am now. But I saw a lot of myself in her when I first encountered her. And then of course, that was in the Two Towers. And then continuing to read on and seeing what she accomplished. And one thing that struck me at the time, again with the judgment of a nine-year-old, is that she totally settled when things, and I've realized spoiler free, so I won't go into detail about that, but I kind of had that mentality.
Do you still
think she settled?
Oh, are you there?
Apparently we've struck her dumb.
Oh dear. I am going to pause recording for 2 seconds.
So I actually have changed my mind as I've grown older and appreciate better the different perspectives of what masculinity can look like and how people can fit together. And I found a man who was much like
so I'm the last person to know. So go ahead. I know.
I'm okay to say. Yes, I did find my own Faramir.
So. Awesome.
And they've even done the costumes in years past.
Oh, sweet. We have a leather, faux leather chest piece that with the two tower or with the tree on it. So anyway, for my husband. But I did find my Faramir, and I appreciate how he was able to create space for her where she didn't have to adjust to expectations. He was able to be who she was. The nobility that she was able to shine through, and she wasn't standing in someone else's shadow. So
I'm going to cry now. Yes, that is healthy masculinity. Beautiful. Love it.
Save the crying for the actual discussion. Anyway, go ahead, Hillary.
So anyway, but that evolution of perspective and understanding, I think plays into it, you know, in real life. I've been a stay-at-home mom for years. We discussed earlier, I have a son with autism. And so these were roles that so there was a certain amount of societal expectation. There was a certain amount of necessity that I step up and fill these certain roles. And I didn't really have a professional life. I didn't have as much that I was doing outside the home. And it was just kind of serendipitous. About 4 years ago, I saw a Facebook exchange between a couple friends, and I was like, I wonder what they're talking about. And I went in to look, and it was a local politics issue. Mm-hmm. And that was what first got me involved, is that conversation, because I knew both people on both sides, and I was just trying to learn more. And it was a ballot initiative. I ended up having to take a side, which was hard because, like I said, I had friends on both sides. Mm-hmm. And but as I saw what happened to my hometown with this issue, and how it kind of tore our town apart a bit, I was realizing that a lot of the problems that were behind that issue were caused in the state legislature. Mm. And so I decided to run for office, to try and get into that state legislature to help take care of my hometown. And so it was quite a leap from being a bit of an introvert and a writer and stay-at-home mom to running for office and putting myself out there and saying, yes, I'm worth voting for, and mm-hmm. here's why. So it kind of did feel like that AON, the transformation of AON from the role that was expected of her to something pretty wild. So I see AON has been my personal archetype, like I said, since I was 9, but it's been interesting to go through that transformation, and the parts of me that I thought I had lost that I hadn't, mm-hmm. and the parts of me that I've gained along the way mm-hmm. that became invaluable as I was advocating. I had learned to advocate for my son, and so I had some of those skills mm-hmm. that came forward in this new role for me. And it was interesting how much of myself I was able to bring that I didn't expect, pieces that I didn't expect to be valuable did become valuable and even necessary.
I was going to ask you, what part of you do you think was always training for this? Because I think Eowyn was too. I think she wasn't ever content to just be some maid, sitting yeah. there being pretty.
Even when she had to be, she wasn't content with it.
Right. Right. So you've answered the question I would have asked. you found it within you. You already had it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and some of it, in the realm of politics, especially the space that my political viewpoints and party now occupy, it is a space of optimism. It's a space of bringing people together. So mm-hmm. it's not what we typically think of in terms of politics, but mm-hmm. it's a space that as a builder of friendships, as someone mm-hmm. who has tried to weave things together in my own writing and such, it's fun to bring a synergistic approach, that those pieces helped me as I stepped into this realm of politics and tried to bring some of these skills that honestly we've left behind as a society, I think, mm-hmm. unfortunately, mm-hmm. To try and bring those back into the public sphere. It's there sometimes where I still feel like that stay-at-home mom, that daughter next, that Eowyn, when she realizes the lineage of Aragorn. I kind of feel like that sometimes too, that part of Eowyn I relate to. Mm-hmm. But there's that evolution is definitely something that has resonated with me. Even now, I won't tell you how many years later, but it's been decades since I first read Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hey, it's been months for me now. I still am doing my first reading.
I know you were saying that Hillary, it took a while to get through Lord of the Rings. We have so far gone 75 episodes to get through The Hobbit and half of Return of the King. So right. You're in good company.
Right, good. Right. It is rich. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
Yes, and thank you for coming on with us. I understand you still have quite a lot of people in your house, and I heard your dog Autumn barking in the background. So if you need to, we can let you go.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for this. It's so enjoyable, and it's really appreciate you inviting me to participate tonight.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was hard to turn down once I realized that not only had you got the entire thing memorized, but your daughter does as well. And so having her recite it,
parenting win.
Exactly. Hillary just kind of turns to her at the dinner table and said, I've raised you well, which I agree with.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. And welcome back anytime.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Okay, so the Gammers, they have a few things to say tonight.
I should hope so. I have a few questions on what certain words are referring to.
Oh my gosh, I hope we hit them all. So identity itself is, we'll call, a newer word from 1600s. And this is what struck me. And then as I was thinking about Hillary's story, it struck me, because it means sameness and oneness, the state of being the same. So I always saw identity as being a state of a label, maybe, or of articulate, or a definition of who somebody or what somebody is. But I love that idea of sameness. And so I love how she can look back on her past and see in her identity all the different Hillaries that she's ever been, and that how they've informed her. And then how Eowyn could have spoken to her one way at one point in her life and another way in another point in her life. And so I see now that identity is a kind of an equation, because even as a verb, it means to identify is to regard as the same. So it is, I see something, I see you, and then when I see an equal sign in between, I've learned something about both sides of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a really interesting way to think about identity, and it is definitely different from how I had thought of it before, and I didn't even realize I had. We get some lovely archaic terms. Blench is from around 1200, which would be to shrink or to start back, or to give way, or to flinch, dodge. The old English would be blenken, to deceive or cheat. So what an interesting kind of dogleg this word has taken from deceive or cheat to go into shrink or start back, to be the one who's actually frightened of some deception or some cheating. The Proto-Germanic blank would be to shine or to dazzle or to blind. So you can see that going into cheating as well. And so here's this interesting path that this word has taken, as opposed to some words that are the same all the way back to the very first utterances of the very first people. So it's just interesting. A drummond is interesting because D-R-O-M-U-N-D. I could not find that, but I could find dromon. D-R-O-M-O-N. So I'm curious about Tolkien's choice there to kind of alter a word that existed to be close to a real word. It is from the Greek for a runner type of galley. It would have been the most important Byzantine warship from the 5th to the 12th century, and therefore a draft in ship language would be the distance between the waterline and the bottom of the hull. So talking about a ship with a great draft would be how much water it's displacing as it's moving. I love vambrace. What a great word. And so the Gondorians, the Gammers, were just like, Lorien, really? Brace, B-R-A-C means arm. I have a friend named Janet Braccio. B-R-A-C means arm. So a vambrace is some armor that is worn on the forearm. Anglo-French vent, which means before, and bras for arm. So it is before the arm. It is on the forearm there. So I love that word, and I love that if it's made of metal, it will reflect breath. So that was beautiful. Carcass, it really is pronounced carcass, and it's really just another spelling of carcass. So the gammers were very impatient with me because I should have known that. Howe, H-O-W-E, is a burial mound, a temporary one often. It is from the Old Norse haug, H-A-U-G, for mound, or cairn, C-A-I-R-N, a more Celtic word, and from the 1600s would have been considered artificial. And I've been to England where you go along and suddenly there's just this weird hill that's just too symmetrical, and that's a howe. Shiver goes back to the 1200s in this instance relating to middle, low German, Schever, pronunciation, I don't know, S-C-H-E-V-E-R, to splinter, shiver, splinter, phrase to break or to break to shivers, to break into bits. And there you have your pirate language, shiver me timbers.
Shiver me timbers. I was about to reference that.
Yes. So that is possibly a reference to timbers just breaking apart and how you feel if, you know, anyway, if you like that. Bane. I almost cried when I saw this word because I thought a bane is kind of an omen or something negative, but a bane means a killer. It's a slayer. It's a killer. It's a murderer. And it's just sad. Anyway, can't go further. And then succor is from the 1200s again. Earlier would have been more of the French, secours, aid, help. Medieval Latin would be succursus, to help, render assistance. The ancient Latin succorrere, run to help, hasten to aid. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of an elision because it would have had a sub, sub, up to, and correre, to run. So sub correre just becomes succorrere after a while. So it is to run up to something. So the gammers had a lot of words for us. And their last is Dwimmerlack. And I noticed, I thought about it. I don't talk like this, but I've heard others who will say something like, that's really weird like, or he's funny like. And it's I thought that was just kind of an affect, but it is this lingering holdover to this M-E is Middle English, Lorianne. Middle English word for the occult practices or magic. So Dwimmerlack would be magic-like or sorcery-like, like that. So did the gammers cover?
Well, it's also from a Middle English word. Well, it does also mean play in terms of they like, and so spectral or sorceress. So this is someone who is a spectral or occult person who practices these things as well.
Right. And it is,
I was hoping you would mention Dwimmerlack and the howe.
Right. And we won't go in tonight to the Witch King because I have the feeling we're going to get to that in perhaps Silmarillion or Unfinished Tales. We'll have some opportunity to speak a little bit more of the Witch King of Angmar. Now we get to go into the theme in the chapter, and you had made some suggestions when we talked about this earlier. So I'm wondering if you could start with with your thoughts on identity in this chapter. Did you want to just go through page by page, or do you?
I have a couple of different options we could do. So the way that I thought of this chapter originally when I was literally back in May of 2020 when we were starting this whole thing up, I was thinking of how there are different levels of identity in this chapter. We have the Rohirrim, we have the people who are following Aragorn, we have the people in the Aurids and that sort of thing. So we have these collectives. We also have them on this side of, sorry, what?
Oh, yes, and on the side of the foes.
We have the Southrons, the Hadron, the Easterlings, etc. Even the animals and the orcs and the troll men, which I think is offensive. Well, but we won't go into that as much.
And I think it's absolutely offensive to weaponize any animal. So the Mumalik, it's just heartbreaking. And I'd like to put an adjective in, or an adverb in front of heartbreaking, but this is a family-friendly podcast, so I won't. Anyway.
This is ruddy heartbreaking.
Well, the U, the letter U was in the word I was
That's why I cleaned it up a little bit. But then within these collectives, we have some people who stand alone. And for me, the ones that it really are marked are the Witch King and the Chieftain of the Haradrim. And so we have these people who, no matter where they are in the place of their collective, they are identified by their individual actions. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we have families, or we have fellowships, which we have in the first and second part of the chapter, and then we have individual storylines. So we could go all over the place.
Why don't we start at those larger, the en masse. Say something, what would you like to say about the Rohirrim?
Oh, let me see. I know half of the quote that I have in my mind, but I have to find the exact quote.
While you're looking, I'll say I'm struck by the fact that singing is so important while they're riding. Mm-hmm. Éomer sings in response to Théoden's death. Éomer sings when he thinks he's about to get demolished. Éomer sings when he realizes he's not about to get demolished. These are a people for whom singing is part of their identity. I was really struck by that. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm pulling this up on my book because it's easiest to find it there. Well, just a second.
I'll say one more thing then. This kind of sternness and this, it was hard to read at first and hard to kind of grasp, but this kind of almost death wish that they were willing to be utterly destroyed because they knew they'd live on in a song. And so I know there's a lot written about that, and I don't want to get to the meta level outside the book, but I just want to talk about these people as so grim and so stern that they are not frightened of dying. Completely, every single one of them getting wiped out because they know there will be a song written about it. So, all right. What did you have?
For me, I finally found it, and I did have the quote right in my head. This is when the Rohirrim have this great assault before the walls of Gondor, but it says, "But lo, suddenly in the midst of the glory of the king, namely Théoden, his golden shield was dimmed. The new morning was blotted from the sky. Dark fell about him, horses reared and screamed. Men cast from the saddle lay groveling upon the ground." And his response, which is the quote I was looking for, was, to me, cried Théoden, up Erlingers, fear no darkness. And this, while is a wonderful cry to battle, it is a reminder that they have come to the aid of Gondor after having passed through so much tribulation in their own country and their own kingdom. And so they fear no darkness. And as you said, yes, it is something where they are thinking about who lives, who dies, who sings your story. But it is also something where they know that they have endured this darkness in the past. And this is not something that they should treat as a new threat. So that I think that it really speaks to the nature of the Rohirrim in general.
Beautiful.
How about you?
I was curious, just sort of the Pelennor Fields. Am I correct? I believe this is a place actually where people were living. This is not just a field that was meant for battle. And so I was thinking about its identity because they talk about the things burning. There's homes burning and farms and fields burning. So the Pelennor Fields perhaps fed Minas Tirith. May have been livestock, things like that. And I know there was an effort to get people away and all of that, but yet, of course, the structures are there. And so I just was thinking about that kind of larger purpose of a place and how it becomes then this battlefield, and then even the river, how at the end it's running red, whether it's flood or the sunset, it doesn't matter. It's you know, the water that would have been used to feed the farms and water the livestock is now tainted here by the end of the chapter, and it will recover. But I was thinking about the identity of the field in some way. How about you? Anything else on that kind of grander?
Well, that comment that you had just made reminded me of a book I got back when I was a teenager and very interested in the Civil War. And I was given a book about the citizens of Gettysburg and the ways that they endured the battle that was raging on various parts of their little town and on the ridges around it. And of course, the famous Little Round Top Hill or Seminary Ridge, that sort of thing. But it really strikes me that they have this similar function. I mean, the Pelennor Fields is such a wide-reaching area. I mean, we have the river, but we also have Osgiliath, which is a city on its own, right? We have these ruins, but we also have life that is a cast in that area. Mm-hmm. For me, I love that the second paragraph of the entire chapter is talking about the pretty overwhelming force of the Rohirrim. It says, Theoden, king of the Mark, had reached the road from the gate to the river, and he turned towards the city that was now less than a mile distant. He slackened his speed a little, seeking new foes, and his knights came about him, and Derenhelm was with them. Ahead near the walls, Elfhelm's men were among the siege engines, hewing, slaying, driving their foes into the fire pits. Well, nigh all the northern half of the Pelennor was overrun, and their camps were blazing. Orcs were flying towards the river like herds before the hunters, and the Rohirrim went hither and thither at their will. And so this first glimpse that we have, of the Rohirrim after all the things that we have been seeing about it, the Siege of Gondor with the catapults launching the heads of the people who died in fighting the enemy, and the terror that they're living under, and the desperate ride towards Osgiliath of Faramir and his men. We then have this paragraph that is just utterly concentrating the power that the Rohirrim have to overwhelm the enemy that has been, it's kind of insurmountable at this point. And so it's the first glimpse of hope that we have is in the unification and in the purpose of the Rohirrim for me.
What do you think about the Valar and their identity here? I mean, the wind comes up and changes, clears the sky, and then eventually we have a rain that helps to put out the fires. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the Valar are influencing or helping here at all?
That's a hard question, because my first answer is, well, if Homer can do it, so can Tolkien.
Yes.
Because in the Iliad, we have frequent references to how, yes, this man carried out this great act of war, but it's because Aphrodite was standing in his way to make sure he survives this whole thing. But I think that it literally is more to the point of shall prove but mine instrument, as we're often quoting, and of course our Friends of the Prancing Pony podcast do.
Well, and then also by the end of everything, the prince, Imrahil, I think that's the right name, right?
Yes, Abdol
Amroth. Éomer and Aragorn are unscathed in this whole day. And so I see there also, I don't know who of the Valar created the second beings to wake up, but is that Manwë? I don't know. Anyway, yell at me all you want, but anyway, I just feel like even there is the hand of the Valar, the shall prove but mine instrument, the hand of Iluvatar participating in an appropriate level. It's not it's not like the gods or the mighty taking over for those who are really meant to do the fight, but just that helping hand. So I felt like in that larger sense of identity, there they were doing what they were created to do. They brought the wind, they brought the rain, and they brought they seemed to protect those leaders mm-hmm. who were needed.
Well, also, these elements other than the protection of the leadership are really things that would be in other circumstances not very extraordinary. But on the other hand, we have this absolutely unnatural fume or fog or darkness that is cast forth mm-hmm. by Sauron mm-hmm. from the land of Mordor.
Right.
And so I think it's very significant that we have these natural elements that are from the beginning powers assigned by Eärendil Ilúvatar to those who serve him.
Right.
So my answer is yes and no.
Yes and no. I don't even hear the no anymore. I just don't hear it. But also on that larger scale, right now the Gondorians are leaderless, mm-hmm. essentially. I mean, I realize the prince has agreed and all of that. Denethor is useless. And I didn't realize, because I had to read ahead actually yesterday because I was just too upset. So that the next two chapters actually take place during this day. So mm-hmm. Gandalf can't even lead or participate because the Gondorians are leaderless and he is wrapped up in what is going on with Denethor. So there mm-hmm. is, for the Gondorians who are used to having their leader, and now they are leaderless. And there are places in this chapter which shows them frightened, losing control, calling for retreat, things like that. So it was interesting to kind of see them. It is a temporary condition, but they are there. They're in that place of being unleadered at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, the final place in terms of the Rohirrim that we mm-hmm. see this grander perspective is actually one of the more intimate moments of the chapter mm-hmm. by some accounts, but it's when Théoden has been killed. Eowyn has had her moment of revelation and Merry has played his part, and we have one of the knights took the king's banner from the hand of Guthwaf, yeah. the banner bearer who lay dead, and he lifted it up. Slowly Théoden opened his eyes, and I'm sorry I said that Théoden was dead. We have not killed him yet. I You're apologize right. for that mistaken statement. Seeing the banner, he made a sign that it should yes. be given to Éomer. Hail, mm-hmm. King of the Mark, he said. Ride now to victory, bid Éowyn farewell. Mm-hmm. And so he died and knew not that Éowyn lay near him. And those who stood by wept, crying, Théoden King, Théoden King. And so I yeah. love this moment in which Théoden, while he is hoping that he is able to communicate a farewell to his people, and especially to his niece, his duty is on his mind to the end, where he ensures that the next king is in place before mm-hmm. he leaves this world.
Lovely, because for me that was a family moment, and you are right, it is also that kind of national moment or larger moment, but I saw the family there, and mm-hmm. he has repeatedly referred to Éomer as his son and Éowyn as his daughter. It's very clear in his head that they are his heirs, and so I see that also as the father to the son transmitting that line. So it's both, and it's wonderful. So that might be a great segue to go into maybe more of the family yes. category.
Well, I think it's very just, there is a lot concentrated on the relationship between Darren Helm and her, or his lord, as we think at the moment, until someone pulls off of it in their helmet and describes themselves as no living man am I.
Right.
But
I love how at the beginning it says the knights are drawing close to Théoden, and Darren mm-hmm. Helm becomes among them. So for that moment, I'm going to say she, because we know she is
a knight. For 5 seconds.
She's his knight at that point. She is one of his knights. And so that's in the family level, perhaps also on the larger level. But I think because of her family feelings, mm-hmm. she has made herself one of his knights in this moment. And she mm-hmm. stays close. And then she's the only one who is not slain when the Nazgul, when the Ringwraith, when the Witch King appears. And so she, you know, whether they had fled or been killed or whatever, it is only a family member who is left there. And so she is by identity Ammon's daughter, but she is like Théoden's daughter to the very end, and is as loyal to him as any family member. And then I also found it striking that, okay, we're meant to think of Dern Helm as this other character. And yes, in some ways she is someone else at times. Mm-hmm. And so she has this relationship, this kind of intimate relationship with Dern Helm, because she's not only that.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, I love the description. This is really close to the passage that we read at the beginning, back a couple of paragraphs before. It's talking about how in response to the black-mantled, huge and threatening Nazgul that is on this fell beast, for lack of a better term, but mm-hmm. the creature that he's riding. And it says, but Théoden was not utterly forsaken. The knights of his house lay slain about him, or else mastered by the madness of their steeds were borne far away. Mm-hmm. Yet one stood there still, Dernhelm the Young, faithful beyond fear, and he wept, for he had loved his lord as a father. Mm-hmm. Right through the charge, Mary had been borne unharmed behind him until the shadow came. Mm-hmm. And so I love that there are really only two categories that you can think of. You are either dead on the ground, or you are fleeing for your lives and out of your mind with terror, except for this person who is faithful beyond fear. So of course, when Dern Helm is revealed, or rather Dern Helm meaning hidden helmet, mm-hmm. this is someone who really, it's not supposed to be a surprise, because if you look at it closely enough, who else could it have been, really?
Right.
Tolkien is not someone who sets up characters to have a moment in the sun just for the spur of the moment glory. This is someone who has been deliberately developed to be the one who is faithful beyond fear. And of course, that's the person who is writing to ride into the paths of the dead in order to serve her country or her kingdom. So I keep on referring to the country as kingdom. Country is a region, kingdom is the political designation. So I'm going to keep those straight from now on.
All right. That is fine. Ammer becomes like a son to Théoden, and then becomes king, leader, and avenger of this father's death. So there is his identity in there. And then I was really struck by Snowmane in the poem. He's servant and bane.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just... it's just such a sad moment. And we'll return to that in Hevruta. So I won't go too much farther than that. Any other family conversation that dynamic. You wanted to have? Dynamic.
Let me double check anything in terms of that. And don't worry, people, we are going to get to the other people who are on the field of battle other than the Rohirrim. We're just really, really focused on this epic moment for the House of Errol.
Well, it's funny. Yes, we're really so far focused on what 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pages. That's about it that we've been talking about. And there's several more and other. There's a whole other climax that happens in this chapter. We'll get there. We will get there. Yes.
Okay, well, that is it for the family dynamic that I have.
Well, I would like to talk about family dynamic en masse and individual in the person of Mary, if I may, because
please do.
As an individual, he is sickened in fear. He is crawling and blinded and ill in fear from this fell beast, and he is terrified. So there he is, just horrified, but something in him calls to himself, King's man, you must stay by him, as a father you shall be to me. So there he sees himself in identity as a son-like figure, servant, son, knight, as a father you shall be to me, you said. But his will made no answer and his body shook. He dared not open his eyes. But it's when Eowyn speaks, he gets his courage back. And mm-hmm. I love that. And then it says, very amazement for a moment conquered Mary's fear. And he finally opens his eyes and the blackness was lifted and he sees her. And then pity fills his heart and great wonder. And suddenly the slow kindled courage of his race awoke. So there's the en masse. Mm-hmm. And this is when I'd like to refer back, if my computer would let me. But though his fear was so great that it seemed to be part of the very darkness that was round him, he found himself as he lay thinking about Bilbo and his stories of their jogging along together in the lanes of the Shire and talking about roads and adventures. There is a seed of courage hidden, often deeply, it is true, in the heart of the fattest and most timid hobbit, waiting for some final and desperate danger to make it grow. Frodo was neither very fat nor very timid. Indeed, though he did not know it, Bilbo and Gandalf had thought him the best hobbit in the Shire. He thought he had come to the end of his adventure and a terrible end, but the thought hardened him. He found himself stiffening as if for a final spring. He no longer felt limp like a helpless prey. There it is, mirrored here on the fields of Pelennor. I can talk. And I love that troika of pity, wonder, and courage. Mm-hmm. And pity is this grand theme, of course, in the whole story, because without pity, you know. And the wonder, which is such a characteristic of hobbits, I think, or at least of these brave hobbits that are willing to go on a journey. And then the courage, that seed sprouts right there. So there in Mary is the en masse, the large, the familial, and the individual. I just love that. And he gets brave enough. And so we don't really know. I mean, Eowyn is of the species of man. So is it Mary's strike that really is the downfall? Or is it just that it's the both of them being the unexpected? I mean, I don't care what the right answer is. They're both exactly who was needed in the moment. And anyway, shall we go on with more in the individual?
I was going to say that, of course, we have a slight answer to that, but it's at the end of the chapter when they're talking about the purpose of having a Merry strike with the blade that he got from the Barrowdowns, and I'd have to find it, but it is something that was used in another battle against Witch King, and so it is this very long and fortuitous thing that he has come this far with a blade that was originally bestowed upon him in time of great peril, and perhaps he thought of not considering it a gift that he acquired, but it is something that was a burden. But if he had not accepted it, he would not have been able to do this. So Spibimi
and sine qua non.
Yeah.
So passed the sword of the Barrowdowns, work of Westerness. But glad would he have been to know its fate, who wrought it slowly long ago in the North Kingdom, when the Dúnedain were young, and chief among their foes was the dread realm of Angmar and its sorcerer king. No other blade, not through mightier hands, not though mightier hands had wielded it, would have dealt that foe a wound so bitter, cleaving the undead flesh, breaking the spell that knit his unseen sinews to his will. Yay, Mary.
No kidding.
So on the individual level, what would you say here?
Well, you've taken my focus from Mary because we've already discussed that. So we have Darrenhelm, and I don't even know where to start with her, because I mean, this has been growing since her first introduction to her back in the Two Towers, and like I said, it makes sense that the culmination of all of this is this moment in which her position as no living man mm-hmm. is the thing that is causing the victory. She is the exceptional person and the exceptional form in this entire battle, as others are, but in terms of this, I mean, she is really a hand and a tool of Iluvatar in order to defeat this great enemy, just as much as Mary's sword is, and of course in a greater measure because of her valor in this action. But it really comes down to the faithful beyond fear nature of it. The entire thing has been her seeking for a purpose. And if I had been the one to give our identity story today, I would have briefly talked about the idea that I, for years, have been struggling to find what exactly my purpose is. And one thing that I have discovered is that I am someone who is voracious about things that can help in a time of crisis. And so she has been the same sort of figure. And so everything that she has done, everything that she has learned at her uncle's court, has led her to both this loyalty and to this action.
Right, right. And she was probably doing training that that she had to do in secret. I mean, how do you stand there when this beast shrieks at you and just not even move, not blench? How do you do that? She is absolutely heroic there. She is amazing. Oh my gosh. I was thinking of Imrahil there, and I'm calling him the Prince of the Cool Head. He just swoops in and knows what needs to be done. And he, in a way, stands in for me for the feminine. For, I mean, he sees Theoden and Eowyn and is bright enough to realize that she is still alive and to call for a leech. We talked about the leech last episode, so we all know what a leech is. So he's got kind of that cool head there. And I just am so grateful for that. And so when, and then later when, I don't know if I'm getting into another chapter. I can't remember where it ends in the next two chapters, but he is for a time in charge of Gondor and he is the right person for it while Strider is sleeping in a tent outside. Or not sleeping in a tent outside, but we'll get to all of that. So, other individuals
addressing Prince Imrahil, I love that you mentioned the kind of his tied to the feminine. But what it reminded me of is a famous quote from Macbeth, "Unsex me now," which for me refers to taking action without consideration of what's expected of particular genders or particular roles. And so I see the Prince of the Dol Amroth as someone who is acting in a, I'm not going to say the word that I'm thinking of, but in a non-gendered role, and that is completely valorous and that is completely needed at this point.
He's being a mother right now. Yep. It's being the mom, and a mom is needed, and moms are ferocious fighters too.
But moms are also the ones who know that at some points you have to give up the fighting or give up your resistance to things and listen to what's best for you.
Right. So he's a wonderful character. So I am grateful for him. So my goodness. I mean, we have so much in this chapter. Oh my goodness. I'm struck just by how the chapter begins, because it's as though we didn't even have the chapter of the Ride of the Rohirrim, because we have this conflict or this face-off between Gandalf and the Witch King on a horse. But when he hears the horns and the rooster, he turns away and he goes off and gets this other beast, the winged beast. So he left the gate and vanished. So it's just, it's such an interesting identity thing. He sees that things are changing too soon. Fortune has betrayed him for the moment. The world had turned against him. Victory was slipping. And so he changes his tactics. So he's in this, I don't know what that necessarily says about identity, except that all he wants is victory, period. Mm-hmm. And so there's other characters here who just run away. You know, such was the fury of the Northmen that the Southrons, flee to the river, whatever. But this guy, he just comes up with another tact. So he's kind of this ruthless person who can only think about victory. And he assumes he's going to win. He assumes up to the very end, even to the point of threatening this torture. Ooh, you won't be killed. You'll be taken to
the I hate that part.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm just flipping through the chapter here just to see what else.
Well, I mean, if we're going to talk about a single character within the context of a whole, let's talk about Aragorn.
Let's! It really is almost like two chapters.
It so is.
Well, and I put this in our Facebook group. I mean, it's almost like I can predict this now. I can predict that I will turn into a goosebumpy pile of mush whenever I read the chapter or the paragraph about the banner being unfurled. And, stern now is Amor's mood. His mind was clear. So, okay, he sees these ships. He thinks this is terrible. This is a new horrible enemy coming. All right, we can do this. We can do this. And then wonder took him in a great joy. I'm so fascinated by Amor. We will get to Aragorn, I promise. And he cast his sword up in the sunlight and sang as he caught it. And all eyes followed his gaze, and behold, upon the foremost ship, a great standard broke. And so I can absolutely rely on goosebumps happening. I can read this like three times in a row, and I will just come to pieces. Aragorn has got perfect timing.
And well, a perfect it's not sense often of that the I dramatic. Recommend this. It's not often that I recommend something outside of the Peter Jackson films for The Lord of the Rings, because those are so marvelous. But the animated version of The Return of the King is the best representation I have ever seen of this moment with a standard unfurling. So if you haven't seen it yet, people, go out and watch it.
I have not. Who did that?
Rankin and Bass.
That is the Rankin and Bass. So yeah. The Hobbit was somebody else, but Rankin and Bass was Lord of the Rings? Oh dear.
No, I'm sorry. So we have the Rankin and Bass Hobbit. We have the Rankin and Bass Lord of the Rings for the Return of the King only. Ralph Bakshi does the Fellowship of the Ring and select parts of the Two Towers. And I'm going to say no more about that.
That's fine. Okay. But I should look at the Rankin and Bass Return of the King. Okay.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. So start us off with Aragorn here.
Oh, sorry, I had to switch to a different page to get that reference correct. Okay, I found the, of course, it's going to be a bit of a, well, we don't know if it's specifically a song, but it is some verse. It says, out of doubt, out of dark to the day's rising, I came singing in the sun, sword unsheathing, to hope's end I rode and to hearts breaking. Now for wrath, now for ruin, and a red nightfall.
There's Amor there, where he's ready to die. Ready to die. We're all going to be destroyed, but we're not giving up. These ships are coming full of corsairs, and we're just going to go.
I don't know if anyone else here has as much fondness as I do for the movie, the episode 9 of Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, but there is a moment in which they have been struggling against the Empire, and they realize that they are about to be completely wiped out in this one terrible battle. And the line is, there are too few of us, but there are more of us. And it's a interaction of dialogue, and it's this moment where you believe that it is completely overwhelming, but there is a hidden hope. And so this is where it really comes back to it. So this coming of the quote-unquote Corsairs of Unbar and turning out to be Aragorn And it says, thus we meet again, though all the horse of Mordor lay between us, said Aragorn. Mm-hmm. Did I not say so at the Hornburg? Mm-hmm. So you spoke, said Aomer, but oft hope oft deceives. And I knew not then that you were a man foresighted. Yet twice blessed is help unlooked for, and never was a meeting of friends more joyful. And they clasped hand in hand, nor indeed more timely, said Aomer. You come none too soon, my friend. Much loss and sorrow has befallen us. Then let us avenge us ere we speak of it, said Aragorn. And they rode back to battle together. And so Aragorn, oh my gosh, this man who has come from the stranger in the prancing pony to the man who arrives on the field of battle and does not look for what the odds are. He's really a little bit of a Han Solo at this moment, but he just knows what his duty is and what he can bring and what force he has summoned. And booyah. I don't say that booyah. A lot, but I'm sorry. I have to say booyah.
Booyah.
Scene.
Okay, this episode title has been decided now. Well, and Aomer has just said earlier, well, he doesn't say, he looked to the river and he's seeing these ships and hope died in his heart. So for a moment there, Aomer is hopeless before he returns to that kind of grim eagerness. I don't even know what to call it. I know the philologists and the sagaists call this Germanic thing. But this kind of joy in death or the long defeat, as Galadriel talks about it, anyway, so hope died within before he sang that song, out of doubt, out of dark, to the day's rising in the sun. So for a moment, hope dies while it's actually hope arriving. So Aragorn is, what is his identity? He is hope, that's part of his name. He is a friend.
Right. He is Estelle.
He is a friend. He is, let's just call him a spouse, because who made the standard? Okay.
Yeah, his lady or Arwen.
He is a king coming to serve his people before he's even accepted as king. And his steward wants to reject him, which we'll see in a page or two. His steward is not interested in this person. So he's still in some ways Longshanks, Strider, Ranger, the stranger. So he is many things always, but I love how he can harness all of those when he appears and be all of those people all at once. Well, I don't know if you remember, and I mean, I wrote about it in Second Breakfast, Aragorn as deer. So please go and read that. D-E-E-R. He stands for every living thing. Sorry, I don't mean to overblow it. But when you look also at how heroic so many people have been in this chapter, Théoden and Aomer and Imrahil and nameless people who are now dead on the ground, and Eowyn and Merry. He is one piece of that, and he's not seeking to be the biggest piece of it. That is maybe the greatest part of his identity right now. He does not need to be biggest hero. He's just there to help and be there in time. And
hello, servant leader.
Mm-hmm, servant leader. Oh, right. That's part of his identity, too. Oh my goodness.
It, not to be heretical or anything, but I remember a person going through the Bible and finding all of the names by which Jesus is referred to. And I think we've done a little bit with some of the characters throughout this.
Yes, I don't find it heretical at all. And of course, Tolkien was a man of faith, and he would never have put Jesus in just one character. He would have put the saving hope in many people, because we are all called to be Christ in the world. We're not supposed to say what a great job Jesus did. We're supposed to take up our own work and do it. And that applies outside of Christianity, in my opinion. And so I see that with Tolkien is saying that, it is the, let's say, the church or the strength of Middle Earth is the people. It is not a particular structure or building. It's not It's not Indurel. It's not the ring even. Mm-hmm. It is its people. And those are elves and dwarves and men and hobbits. There's identity for you. Mm-hmm.
And just to back up, well, not back up, but to reinforce what we kind of think of him with, it is that came Aragorn, son of Arathorn, Elessar, Isildur's heir, out of the paths of the dead, born upon a wind from the sea to the kingdom of Gondor. And two things strike me in terms of spiritual or sacred reading with that. First of all, the path out of the paths of the dead.
Yeah.
This is a resurrection of the hope that was abandoned when he went into the paths of the dead, as we see with his reunion with Éomer.
Éomer and Éomer were convinced he was going to die, that he would never get out.
And if I had a Havruta question, I would probably say, do you think that Aragorn at any point wondered if he would be emerging from the paths of the dead? And I'm not sure I have a question, an answer for that, but that's why I had to ask it for Havruta. Mm-hmm. But then born upon a wind from the sea to the kingdom of Gondor. And there is a verse in, I know it's in John chapter 3, I believe it's following chapter and verse 16, but I'm not sure how many verses afterwards. It says that the wind bloweth wherever it pleases, so shall they be who are born of the spirit. And so I really might be overreaching, but I believe that this is a reference to the divine power that is enabling him to come at this time and with these tools by the hand of this person who keeps on talking about it, proving but mine instrument.
That's why I asked that earlier. Does this wind come to help because of the particular Valar associated? I know there's a proper name for that, but I'm not there yet. Does that rain come and put out the fires because of the Valar who is assigned to that? Does some Valar protect Aragorn, Éomer, and this prince and keep them from any harm? You know, not to take over, but because of the will of Iluvatar. I know what you're
Valar, who's master of the winds, is the same one who sends the eagles into such catastrophic moments, namely Manwë. And so it is possible that this is a direct reference to Manwë with the born of the wind from the sea to the kingdom of Gondor.
Yeah. It's not in John chapter 3, it's later, but yeah, you went out to the wilderness, and what did you see? A reed bent by the wind? I think that's what you're thinking of, but I can't find I can't find it. Well, it's not in chapter 3, there's no mention of wind in chapter 3, but anyway.
I have to say that the reason why I think this is in John chapter 3 is I had to memorize that chapter and do it as a monologue in 11th grade.
Okay.
And I memorized that verse at some point.
At some point. All right. We'll find the right place if anybody's curious. So shall we move on to our actual Havruta?
Well, are there any other characters you wanted to take into account individually, or do you think we're good?
I am good. Do you? Okay. Do you?
Well, I was just going to say, I've been rambling for quite a long time on a bunch of different people, so if you want to get a word edgewise, you are perfectly welcome to do so.
I appreciate that. I am content. I would also be content if you and I started back at chapter one at some point and continued doing sacred readings of Lord of the Rings after we're done with whatever we do after. Anyway, so there we are. Right. So I don't know if I even have the words for this question, because part of it is just this emotional wail that comes out at me. And it relates to Théoden dying, and it relates to identity. So I'll just start from the personal. This just feels like such a wasted death, such a needless death. And I'm so, so broken by it. And and so I'd like to discuss this. And so my question would be, because Éomer breaks into song, mourn not over much, mighty was the fallen, meet was his ending. So my question is, how, in what way was his ending meat? And of course, by meat, we say, I should have looked that up or asked the gammers.
For meat, me, the
appropriate, suitable.
Sufficient.
Sufficient. So how, in what way is his end sufficient? Is his death sufficient? Because I'm not seeing it. And I realize that for Hevruta, I start the dialogue by answering it first. And so my half-hearted answer is that perhaps he was older. He's been freed from the effects of Wormtongue, but he is an old man. He has led his people this far, and maybe that really was the purpose for him. He has done, I mean, obviously, and also his people are trained. I mean, they are completely trained. They are a well-oiled machine, as I said earlier. So part of my answer would be that his life's work was to prepare these Rohirrim for this fight, and he got them there. So maybe that is enough. So what would you say? What is your answer?
This is also a very hard question for me because I don't have a good answer. Well, Hevruta really is about speculation, and I wish that I could be writing an essay on this and find a handy citation that really works for this question. But for me, it really comes down to the old alliances between Gondor and Rohan, where they were once part of the Kingdom of Gondor. And so there was a sundering in the past, and they have had their independence, and they have had places as which they have been at counter purposes, but they still hold this loyalty to each other towards the end. But this is kind of the passing of the old guard, is so that Theoden has lived to see the days renewed in which Gondor and Rohan are able to fight against a common enemy and find victory of some kind. And we talked, you and I, about the felled black serpent and the significance of that. But I think it really is that he has come to the end of the purpose for which they entered into this war. And now in terms of establishing peace and residing in this victory that is to come, they need someone who will be a different leader. And so I think it's appropriate that it is passed on to Éomer.
I agree. So then it's a lot, you know, but what do you think if Gandalf had been able to participate on this day, on the battle, do you think Théoden might have lived? So there's another hard question. And so my answer, if I'm cheating and having two Hevruta questions, but
we can have like 50,000 of them, but we do have to go out to
I have to go to bed. Yeah. my answer would be yes, because I want him to have a greater victory than just killing this black serpent that we've just met. We've literally just sort of been described this enemy and its mantle or its flag and all of that. And he kills the person and then breaks their flag. So I'm unsatisfied. I'm just unsatisfied. And so I just see some kind of greater triumph for him. And I don't know what it would be if Gandalf had been there. Is that realistic?
Well, I think it's realistic. And I think it speaks to Gandalf's nature as a student of Vinyana, who is, of course, the Valar assigned to, but who is the mentor of those who have pity and to those who know how to weep. On the other hand, I can see it that Gandalf, in trying to do as much good to stand between those who are not up to the stature of the great warriors who are going to overcome certain evil elements, such as the Witch King of Angmar, he would have probably left the Rohirrim, or at least part of them, to themselves so that he could give aid to others. And so I could see him not being able to save Théoden and mourning and having pity for the House of Eorl and everything that has been lost, but seeing the wisdom in what has been done in this moment of victory. So We can agree to disagree.
I'm not even sure we disagree. I'm not even sure. I just...
We have different perspectives and that's never disagreeable.
That's not disagreeing and it's fine. So then just going back to Mary with the pity, the wonder, and then the courage, mm-hmm. is the pity a gift of Gandalf where he sends a thought out to Mary somehow? Or is the pity actually a gift perhaps of Nienna? We're talking about the Valar. Participating today is Nienna, perhaps helping Mary.
I'm more inclined to say that it's done indirectly from Nienna because, of course, Gandalf is a pupil of hers, mm-hmm. and at times he is an intercessory figure. But yeah. I think in this moment, it is definitely something more direct.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know minute by minute what Gandalf is doing. And I know he is quite occupied on this day. Mm-hmm. And, oh my goodness. So, well, thank you. It's just, you know, I think the perfect Havruta is one where it goes from question to question. And mm-hmm. I actually hope that others have more questions or more thoughts on these questions that I have raised and that Catherine has responded to. And really, we're not disagreeing. There's no really set answer. And it's really just an emotional response. I wasn't ready to let go of Theoden. It just really, really wasn't.
Well, as I'm hit, he's my favorite character. And so, you know, I wasn't ready to let him go, but luckily I've read this before and I managed to not cry this time.
this time, yes. Do you have any exhortations for characters or outside the book?
Oh man, I really just exhort us all to be faithful to beyond fear, to a cause, to a person, to anything that we see as worthy of love and worthy of loyalty. So be like Darren Helm, and you too may be this really incredible figure.
we will get our chance. Yeah, I can't top that. No, my exhortation is also the same. Be Darren Helm. Yes, we. And sometimes we do actually even have to hide, but be prepared and know that your gifts will blossom at the right time. You'll need them and you'll have them. So don't ever think you've wasted time learning something or preparing something or reading something or whatever, because it will be used. It will be used. And I love that. Don't give in to fear, have the faith. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. So join us next week when we will be discussing chapter 7 of The War of the Ring, The Pyre of Denethor, through the theme of stubbornness. And we get to return to the sacred practice of Pardes. Yay!
Oh, goody.
That's my favorite.
I love Pardes, but I love Pardes.
I love Havruta. I love Lexi and Arena. I love them all. But I'm so excited to go back to the Garden of Pardes, paradise. All right.
So if you hadn't noticed, this is usually where we talk about the notes from the Shire, which I do have a brief one.
Okay.
And it actually goes to a quote, but and I'm probably skipping around on the agenda because I went to find the quote that I wanted to use.
Okay.
But only she and I know exactly what order goes, things go in. But so you asked in our community Facebook group, where do you see identity in the Battle of the Pelennor Fields? And Arthur Harrow gave a two-word answer that absolutely broke me, which is, he said, dog tags.
I know. I cried.
And I'd like to read the passage that this brings to mind, because we have these thousands upon thousands of dead lying in the mounds of Mundberg.
Thank you.
But it said, neither Hirluin the Fair would return to Penethgellan, nor Grimbald to Grimslade, nor Halbarad to the Northlands, dour-handed ranger. Mm-hmm. No few had fallen, renowned or nameless, captain or soldier, for it was a great battle, and the full count of it, no tale has told. So thank you, Arthur, for making me tear up in the middle of reading that two-word answer.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, in the meantime, I should tell you where to find us.
Please tell us, tell everybody where to find us, please.
We do love hearing from you, and our community is growing stronger every day. Mm-hmm. And actually, we have some really exciting just spikes in numbers that have nothing to do with whether or not we're tracking the pandemic. So we look at our numbers and the people joining in, and it's a joy to us all. Mm-hmm. But if you'd like to join our Facebook community and add to our joy, please look for us at A Sacred Fellowship. On Twitter, we are A Sacred Fellows 1, and Instagram is A Sacred Fellowship. You can also send an email to asacredfellowship@gmail.com. Thanks to all of you for keeping our spirits up and our thoughts flowing. Please read and comment on Second Breakfast at our website, www.asacredfellowship.com.
And we also value the contributions of our Patreon supporters. Your support of the site and hosting costs is much appreciated. If you feel inspired to join their ranks, please look at our options on www.patreon.com/asacredfellowship. Perks have ranged from patron shoutouts to Tolkien-themed presents, and we appreciate every dollar. And this week we have a special perk. All current patrons and any new patron supporters we get between the time this episode is released and October 15th of 2021 will get a hard copy of Catherine's new book, Miracle on Deck 34, as a thank you.
And I literally just saw that on the agenda, which made me kind of choke up, but I look forward to doing that. And if Lorianne can have those shipped to me, I can even sign them for you before sending them out.
I will do that. So please sign up to be on our Patreon page. I want to buy a lot of books. A lot of books. This has been an amazing period of time studying this chapter. I still almost feel like I haven't read it. And I've read it so many times, and I still feel like there's so much more to plumb in these depths. So,
and you even haven't seen the movie yet.
Nope. I have not seen the movie.
The movie is life-changing at so many moments, but this is one of my favorites. The Corsairs and the Witch King and Mary and Darren Helm and Theoden. I'm never going to stop talking about how much I love this stuff. So in the meantime, thank you for joining us for our long-winded rambles about just about everything we could think of. And thank you again. To Hillary for joining us from her car, where she was attended by wonderful fans of Lord of the Rings as well. But in the meantime, may Elbereth protect you. Be of good hope. Namarie.
Namarie.